This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 10th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the source behind the NSA surveillance leaks goes public as more details come out about the U.S. government's massive spying programs. In North Carolina, more clergy leaders and activists join a weekly protest at the Capitol that is highlighting recent measures on education, immigration, voting rights, and more. And a climate justice activist calls for renewed organizing from within the environmental community after new evidence shows an increase in global warming. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. Turkey's prime minister spent the weekend rallying supporters in three cities where he warned that his patience with anti-government protesters is wearing thin. But tens of thousands of people continue to demonstrate in towns and cities across the country in what's lining up to be the biggest challenge to date of the government's rule. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports.
A Pots and Pans orchestra performs to thousands of demonstrators inside Taksim's Gezi Park, where protests drew some of the largest crowds since the popular uprising began 11 days ago. Mustafa, a 36-year-old from Istanbul, says the prime minister needs to stop trying to impose a socially conservative agenda and listen to dissenting voices.
He should come to realize that he is only a prime minister. He is not in a situation to dictate what he thinks to our lives, to what we do. I mean, we don't want to be treated as 8-year-olds.
The government continues to insist that this park will be demolished to make way for a commercial project. To protesters, the fate of the park is a symbol of the government's authoritarian style. Meanwhile, in Ankara, authorities have taken an even harder line. Local reports say riot police used tear gas and water cannons over the weekend to disperse demonstrators occupying two central squares. Today, the Consumer Rights Association filed criminal complaints against the Interior Minister, Governor, and Police Chief of Ankara for what they described as indiscriminate use of tear gas that threatened thousands of neighbors who were inside their homes. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Istanbul.
Indonesia is asking Saudi Arabia to postpone a deadline by which workers who have outstayed their visas can qualify for an amnesty program. The request comes after a woman died Sunday while waiting for hours along with thousands of others outside the Indonesian consulate, where the staff was unable to keep up with the influx and the crowd grew violent. Foreign workers in the country are scrambling to meet red tape requirements ahead of a July 3rd deadline that would allow them to either stay in the country or leave without penalty before a promised crackdown on undocumented immigrants. Humphrey Jemmet with the Migrant Workers Task Force spoke to Al Jazeera.
Many Indonesians overstayed their visa. We think in total 40,000 are illegal. And nearly all of them want to come back to Indonesia, but they don't have any documents, not even a passport.
Saudi Arabia is largely dependent on foreign workers to staff its labor force, and many people from countries like Indonesia, the Philippines, and Bangladesh rely on the jobs. Consumer rights advocates say that payments going out this week to thousands of victims of foreclosure abuse in Maryland are woefully inadequate. Maryland News Connections' Allison Burns has more.
The check is in the mail. More than 10,000 Marylanders will get checks for about $1,500 each this week as part of a nationwide settlement with mortgage service providers. The settlement is the result of allegations that the banks engaged in robo-signing of documents and other lending abuses. But Maryland Consumer Rights Coalition Executive Director Marceline White says the money isn't much of a consolation for Marylanders who lost their homes.
This slightly under $1,500 payment is certainly a pittance in terms of what they've actually lost and what they need to rebuild their life.
The settlement was with the nation's five largest mortgage servicers, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citi, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Ally Bank GMAC. All 50 states entered into the agreement. The settlement also required banks to make it easier for struggling borrowers to stay in their homes, but White says they aren't always living up to their end of the bargain.
Banks are doing short sales and other types of relief far more than they're doing the principal reduction, which is when they modify the mortgage to an affordable level to keep a family in their home.
I'm Allison Burns reporting for Maryland News Connection.
Efforts to capture oil spilled in Ecuador and making its way down tributaries to the Amazon River continue. On May 31st, a landslide damaged a section of the Trans-Ecuador pipeline, spilling more than 11,000 barrels of crude oil into the Quijos River. The slick then flowed into the Coca and Napo rivers. The Coca provides drinking water to the region's 80,000 residents. State oil company Petroecuador has hired a U.S. spill abatement firm, Clean Caribbean and Americas, and the Peruvian Navy is helping with the cleanup while Brazilian authorities are on standby. A judge in Florida ruled today that the George Zimmerman murder trial will continue. Zimmerman is accused of the 2012 killing of Trayvon Martin, an unarmed African-American teen. Circuit Court Judge Deborah Nelson denied a defense request for more time to prepare. Judge Nelson will alternate court time between arguments on pretrial motions and jury selection, which also began today. A pool of 100 prospective jurors will be vetted. The victim's father, Tracy Martin, is calling for the community to stay peaceful. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Yesterday, The Guardian revealed the identity of the person responsible for leaking documents showing the U.S. government's massive surveillance of phone and internet users. Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old employee of the large private intelligence contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, said he sought to prompt a public debate on government surveillance.
I'm no different from anybody else. I don't have special skills. I'm just another guy who sits there day to day in the office, watches what's happening, and goes, this is something that's not our place to decide. The public needs to decide whether these programs and policies are right or wrong. And I'm willing to go on the record to defend the authenticity of them and say, I didn't change these. I didn't modify the story. This is the truth. This is what's happening. You should decide whether we need to be doing this.
In an interview with The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald in Hong Kong, Snowden said he had also worked as a systems administrator and a senior advisor to the CIA and had access to extensive data on the NSA's surveillance program. Booz Allen Hamilton, owned by the Carlyle Group, posted $5.7 billion in revenues for the most recent fiscal year, 98% of which came from government funding, according to the New York Times. Snowden described why broad surveillance poses a risk to everyone, not just those who commit illegal acts.
You don't have to have done anything wrong. You simply have to eventually fall under suspicion from somebody, even by a wrong call. And then they can use the system to go back in time and scrutinize every decision you've ever made, every friend you've ever discussed something with, and attack you on that basis to sort of derive suspicion from an innocent life and paint anyone in the context of a wrongdoer.
In identifying himself as the whistleblower, Snowden said his future would be uncertain and he would face risks.
You can't come forward against the world's most powerful intelligence agencies and be completely free from risk because they're such powerful adversaries that no one can meaningfully oppose them. If they want to get you, they'll get you in time. But at the same time, you have to make a determination about what it is that's important to you.
The Department of Justice said it has opened a criminal investigation into the leaking of the NSA documents. The Guardian's coverage of the National Security Agency's surveillance practices continues to develop. Over the weekend, it published details about a global data mining program called Boundless Informant. Under the program, the Obama administration is compiling information about how many tens of billions of data interceptions they carry out each month and in which countries. Despite assurances from the president and government officials that the NSA's surveillance work is narrowly tailored and only aimed abroad, the documents show that U.S. citizens are often targeted. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Among the documents leaked by data analyst Edward Snowden to The Guardian is a world map that shows where the National Security Agency is intercepting communications. The heaviest surveilled countries, colored red on the map, are Iran, Pakistan, Jordan, Egypt, and India. The U.S. is colored orange, showing it's the target of more surveillance by its own government than much of the world. An accompanying fact sheet about the program, called Boundless Informant, states that in March of this year alone, the government collected 3 billion pieces of information from U.S. computer networks. Attorney Patrick Toomey with the American Civil Liberties Union says these revelations disprove claims by the Obama administration that the rights of Americans are being protected. He said the information also calls into question a Supreme Court ruling earlier this year, which dismissed a lawsuit against Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, saying that the plaintiff's concerns that individuals and organizations in the U.S. were being monitored was unfounded speculation.
We do believe that there have been violations of Americans' constitutional rights, especially their right to privacy in their personal communications and personal information. Americans' communications are being swept up en masse as part of a foreign intelligence program that's supposed to be focused on foreign targets and foreign communications.
The information leaked by Snowden over the past week shines a light not only on the surveillance activities of the U.S. government, but also the access many private companies have when they're hired to help. Snowden worked for the firm Booz Allen Hamilton, which has many lucrative contracts with the NSA and other government agencies. Scott Amy with the Project on Government Oversight says there are major ethical and financial concerns about outsourcing this kind of work.
We've done some comparisons where we find that in certain instances, contractor employees are 2, 3, even up to nearly 5 times more than what it costs to hire federal government employees to come in and do the same work. And so we do have to have a debate about both the cost of having contractors do that, but then ethical and legal concerns about having information in the hands of contractors that may pose a personal or organizational conflict of interest. You do have contractors that answer to their senior executives and their board and to their shareholders. And so at that point, their interest may not always be the same as the interest of the American taxpayer and the agencies that they're working for.
Snowden's employer, Booz Allen Hamilton, gave tens of thousands of dollars to the campaigns of both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney last year, and spent tens of thousands more lobbying Congress on military contracting issues over the past decade, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Military contractors like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin have spent exponentially more. Amy says this has led to a situation where companies are influencing the policies they benefit from.
Are we hiring the best and brightest contractors to come in and do work for the federal government, or are we hiring the people that are the most influential or have the most friends inside of the government?
When reporters asked White House spokesperson Jay Carney Monday to respond to Snowden's assertion that the government was inappropriately spying on its own people, he defended the Obama administration's record.
We need to strike the appropriate balance between our national security interests and our interests in privacy. And he believes that with the oversight that exists and the implementation of the programs as they are implemented, that the balance is appropriately struck, has been appropriately struck, but it is an absolutely appropriate topic for debate.
Carney also confirmed that the government has launched an investigation into Snowden's leak of classified information, but refused to give further detail. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Today, protesters rallied outside the Capitol in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's part of weekly protests that organizers call Moral Mondays. This week, an expanded list of clergy leaders from across the state joined the rally, criticizing lawmakers for measures that cut thousands from Medicaid and unemployment. The Republican-controlled General Assembly has also proposed or passed bills curtailing immigration rights, expanding voter suppression laws, imposing cuts to education, and restricting reproductive rights. The weekly actions have resulted in hundreds of arrests. Earlier today, we spoke with Reverend Curtis Gatewood with the NAACP North Carolina. He joined us from the Pullen Memorial Baptist Church, where participants were gathering before the march to the General Assembly.
These policies and proposed legislation and some of the legislation that already been passed is somewhat to the extent where it's a matter of life or death that we stand. For example, when you have policies that will deny 500,000 North Carolinians Medicaid, there has been nothing by this legislature to come in to say, well, since we have such a high unemployment rate, we're going to focus on jobs and making sure that we do that we reduce poverty or minimize unemployment, they've come right in right away denying Medicaid benefits for poor people, cutting unemployment benefits that will leave 170,000 North Carolinians without unemployment benefits who would have otherwise qualified, kicking off about 30,000 children, at-risk children, who would have ultimately been eligible to receive early childhood programs such as MOED 4, Smart Start programs that have proven to be effective in making and preparing children for education, undermining the educational system here in North Carolina. And the list goes on.
Well, Reverend, you bring up several issues there, economics, access to education, health care. There have also been these series of bills that restrict early voting and registration. Some require photo IDs to cast a ballot and other measures. Why is that significant, especially in North Carolina?
Well, first of all, the voting rights, that is the basic right. That is one of the rare times in America where it does not matter where you came from, does not matter what your socioeconomic status is. Everyone had a ballot, and that would put us on a level playing field. That is what democracy is supposed to look like. But instead, we're having hypocrisy where people are coming out trying to do everything they can to stop people from voting. And we have legislation such as Senate Bill 666 that would even punish parents who, if their students voted in a college where they go to college rather than voting at home, it would penalize them $2,500, the tax that they would have otherwise been able to claim had they not had these types of bills being proposed. So they're trying to cut out Sunday voting, where disproportionately African Americans vote. We all know that. They're trying to cut out early voting, disproportionately youth and African Americans, Latinos are voting in high numbers. So it is very clear what the game is. It's not about voter fraud. This type of legislation is the fraud.
There's also, in April, the House Republicans introduced a measure called HB 786 that would allow law enforcement officers to check the immigration status of anyone they stop and detain them for up to 24 hours. The ACLU has said it would lead to racial profiling. What's the concern here?
Yes, well, there's always a concern about immigration laws and making sure that we're giving immigrants a fair chance. We were already concerned about Arizona SB 1070, and we were hoping that one of the reasons we wanted to fight Arizona SB 1070 where it was, so it wouldn't create this snowball effect of bad legislation as it pertains to immigration. So we see this as somewhat of a spinoff, and it could create a door that is going to be closed for immigrants. And we're here to say equal protection under the law for all. We're here to say if it's going to be about showing us your papers, America never showed its papers. It never showed its papers when it came to the Native Americans. It never showed its paper for African Americans who labored here freely and never were provided the resources or the income that they worked for. So if we're going to go down the road of showing papers, there are a lot of papers that need to be showed.
This week, a coalition of clergy members also signed on support for these weekly protests. They have been going on since the end of April. How long do you plan to continue, and what's the impact you've seen so far?
Well, how long we will be here is a question to be asked to the General Assembly. How long will they continue putting out a litany of unjust laws? See, as people of faith, first of all, we're going to reclaim the Bible and not allow people to continue using the Bible as a political football to kick it in any time they get ready for a political point, because we're here saying this is about love and justice.
Reverend Curtis Gatewood is with the NAACP. He joined us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Reverend Gatewood, thank you very much for your time.
You're certainly welcome. God bless you.
Last week, FSRN reported on the plight of Palestinian prisoners and their families, many of whom have long been cut off from visiting their loved ones inside Israeli facilities. Hunger strikes and protests led to an easing of the restrictions on family visits, but many continue to raise concerns about the rights of Palestinians, many of whom are detained without charge. Today, Israel's occupation of Gaza and the West Bank were discussed at the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, and treatment of prisoners was highlighted as a major concern. UN Radio's Patrick Maigua reports.
A United Nations human rights expert is calling for the establishment of a commission of inquiry into the situation of nearly 5,000 Palestinians detained or imprisoned by Israel. Richard Falk, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the occupied Palestinian territories, says Palestinians held in Israeli jails were subjected to inhuman and humiliating treatment, including torture, solitary confinement, lack of access to adequate health care, lack of access to legal representation, and denial of family visits. In a report to the UN Human Rights Council, Mr. Falk says the ill treatment of Palestinian children in Israeli military detention was widespread, systematic, and institutionalized from the moment of the child's arrest, prosecution, and eventual conviction.
The treatment of thousands of Palestinians detained or imprisoned by Israel continues to be extremely worrisome. These issues have persisted without significant correction through 46 years of occupation. My report calls for the establishment of a commission of inquiry into the situation of Palestinians detained or imprisoned by Israel. I recommend that such an inquiry have a broad mandate to examine Israel's track record of impunity for prison officials and others who interrogate Palestinians. Some will say that calling attention to these realities does not advance peace in the Middle East. 46 years of denying Palestinians their most basic rights has not achieved peace, and indeed has consistently diminished Palestinian prospects for a just outcome to the conflict.
Mr. Falk said it was regrettable that 46 years on, today Palestinians continue to live without the protection of laws, without respect for their human rights, and with stifling restrictions on all aspects of their lives. Patrick Maigua, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
As United Nations climate talks continue this week in Germany, the International Energy Agency released a new report showing that the planet is on track to see a temperature rise between 3.6 and 5.3 degrees Celsius. That increase could be more than double the 2-degree threshold previously set as a way to limit the impacts of climate change. Speaking in London, the IEA's executive director, Maria van der Hoeven, said that the climate change has slipped to the back burner of policy priorities and urged world leaders to take more significant actions. CO2 emissions increased worldwide last year by 1.4%, according to the agency, reaching a record high of more than 31 billion tons. But it's not just elected officials who aren't doing enough to stop global warming. Some environmentalists say the activist community should also be doing more. Pacifica Radio's Ernesto Aguilar spoke to climate justice activist Tadzio Mueller at last weekend's Left Forum in New York.
There are a lot of discussions that are happening internationally around the issue of climate justice, but strangely not enough discussion about strategy and where these movements go.
I suppose a good place to start would be the failure of the climate summit in Copenhagen in 2009, the so-called COP15. It might be a bit of a long way to go back, but that's one of the last times the global climate justice movement had real strategy discussions. There, we thought that by targeting the climate summit, we could, in a way, just like we did in Seattle 10 years before, kick off a global movement for climate justice that would really reorganize the field, that would create effects far out of proportion to what we had been able to achieve before. But not only was the climate summit a failure from the governmental perspective, in many ways I'd say it was also a failure from the movement's perspective, because while it became our first goal to show that governments and corporations weren't going to do much to solve the problem of runaway climate change, well, that goal was achieved not so much by us, but by them. They clearly showed that they were a total failure. Our second goal, to constitute a global movement that would be able to fight back against the expansion of fossil fuels, that would really sort of create a global mood that was more favorable to achieving climate justice, to shutting down fossil fuels, to getting out of industrialized agriculture, to forcing the global north to repay the ecological debt that it owes the global south. Now, that in that we failed. We didn't create that global movement. And afterwards, what happened was that the global climate justice movement, if it ever existed, crumbled and retreated into the national spaces. Now, that was not an irrational choice, because folks had seen that in national or local campaigns and struggles, things could be won. But obviously, since then, climate change has accelerated. In 2012, coal constituted a bigger part of the global energy mix than at any time since 1966, I believe. We've seen an escalation of extreme weather events. More and more people are suffering and dying from runaway climate change. So in terms of the goals we had set ourselves, I'd say we failed almost as much as the Global Climate Summit had done.
Why?
Because we never managed to achieve effects at the global level. That's to say, we managed to shut down one coal-fired power plant after another, or we managed to expand renewable electricity production in Germany. But none of this really came together. Folks retreated into their own spaces and into their own struggles, and that was kind of ironic, because before the climate summit in Copenhagen, we kept shouting at politicians and at industry. We kept saying that you have to stop with your old business as usual. You have to stop burning fossil fuels. You have to stop trying to create markets for emissions in order to deal with the climate change problem, because that's not going to happen. So we told everybody else, business as usual is no longer enough. But in a way, we forgot to apply this lesson to ourselves, that our business as usual was also no longer enough. It seems to me that a time has come for us as movements to, first of all, acknowledge our weakness and to draw conclusions from that. The first conclusion is that this is just basically at the level of physics. If you apply a given force, if you apply force to a given object and you cannot achieve a desired outcome, you need to leverage that force. It's very simple physics. If you're trying to push a big rock and you can't push the big rock, you need to find a point of leverage. And then you need to concentrate your forces on that point. And I think that's what's not happening, because we're staying in our activist or trade union or local politician ghettos. We need to, first of all, start a process where we sit down together and identify a point of leverage, and then we need to concentrate all our forces on that point. So the first question is, what's the point of leverage? And the suggestion that I would have would be, we need to focus on the energy sector. I mean, that's not just me. I mean, in fact, this has been a realization of the climate activists for a long time, ever since we realized that the Copenhagen summit had failed. The first point where we can attack and where we have the chance of winning fights is the energy sector. And there we have to do two things. On the one hand, I don't often quote Bill McKibben from 350.org, but he said it quite well. We need to stop the good. We need to stop the bad and start the good. So we need to, on the one hand, stop the expansion of fossil fuels, and on the other hand, promote the expansion of renewable energies. Basically, once we've identified this point of leverage, i.e. the energy sector, we then have to figure out how our different strategies and tactics can come together, complement each other, and create something that's more than the sum of its parts.
That was climate justice activist Tadzio Mueller speaking to KPFT's Ernesto Aguilar at last weekend's Left Forum in New York. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit us online at fsrn.org and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.